Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness, January 25th, 2007, 5 p.m., Hearing Room B, Co-Chairs Kozanski and McPherson.
I'll open an informational meeting of the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness for Thursday, January 25th, 2007. We're going to hear invited testimony from a number of groups, and we're actually, because of some time constraints for some of the folks who are on the calendar, we're going to rearrange the order. We're going to hear first from the bankers group, who are listed last, then second from the Farm Bureau, then third from Oregonians in Action, fourth from Thousand Friends of Oregon, fifth from the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and last from the Oregon Home Builders Association, with apologies to those who are later in the calendar than they might have been otherwise, but that apparently fits people's schedules the best. Before we jump into the invited testimony, I just wanted to offer a comment about an issue that surfaced at our first meeting on Tuesday. We adopted rules at that meeting, and those rules were presented to us as the identical rules that had been adopted by another joint committee for this legislative session. So we went ahead and adopted them in the form as they were presented to us by staff. And we received information from staff about the history of minority reports, and that information was accurate. But we've since learned that there was additional information that wasn't available to us that evening about different past practice on minority reports from joint committees. So the co-chairs of this committee are looking at that history to see how a minority report process should work in a joint committee that's been formed to address pressing issues such as the ones before this committee, and will bring that concept back to a subsequent committee meeting. With that, we'll then go on to the invited testimony and hear first from the Oregon Bankers Association, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, and Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. Please come forward.
Rearrange some furniture here, Mr. Chair. Clearing out the rest of the room.
Yeah.
Putting John Chandler.
That made more room for others.
Yeah.
It's a great point. Going to bring
the people with us. I know.
And once you're settled in, if you could decide your own order as among you, and then start by introducing yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I grabbed the mic first, so it's Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, if nobody minds on the panel. I'll make a couple of brief remarks. You obviously have a broad panel up here today, but with me today, far there on my right, is Ken Sherman, OBA counsel, longtime OBA counsel. He will have some more detailed results or detailed comments, and he has passed out some of those that he put in writing. I wanted to just take a minute and kind of do a brief overview from the Oregon Bankers Association perspective. The association took no position on Measure 37, which is not unusual. They generally do not get involved in initiatives unless they have an immediate and direct impact on the banking industry. Now, I know some up there saying, well, of course this did, but, you know, our PAC is limited and we can only do so many things, so we did not get involved with this. Working and following Representative Garrard's committee last time, as well as the Senate committee, we were obviously very interested in what, if any, changes the legislature was going to make. In its wisdom, in 05, it chose to make none that affected our interests. Now, of course, the several issues are before the courts. Some have got all the way to the Supreme Court, and that's really the issue that we have our greatest concern about. about, and that's the issue of transferability. That has caused, and I will give you just a couple of anecdotal comments. Your invitation earlier this week from Senator Przanski was well-timed in that we had a lending committee, OBA lending committee yesterday, and had representatives from about 30 different banks, all sizes, all around the state of Oregon. There really hasn't been a lot of activity, a lot of loan applications since Measure 37 has passed. Kind of anecdotal, and this was only probably three or four of the banks in that group that have even had applications under 37 claims. And two things seem to be the theme on those. One is appraisals. There was a rural application where they were wanting to build a subdivision, and the bank in question asked the potential borrower to go out and get an appraisal on the property. They were unable to do that. And I think that is an issue that, and I don't know if you have appraisers in one of your groups, in one of your panels in the next couple of days, but I would suggest you would like to talk to them as well, because that has been a big issue since the passage of Measure 37. So because this potential borrower was unable to get an appraisal, the loan was not able to go any farther than discussion stage. There have been a couple others, and they, because of the transferability issue, have not been made. So we're not seeing a huge number, but we are now starting to see them trickle in, which I think you would expect given the fact that some of these claims have now gone through the process with local governments. Obviously, with the huge deluge that came in December, it's going to be interesting to see as those are processed, if folks come into the financial institutions to try to secure loans. With that, I would turn it over to Ken for, again, a little more detail on some of the things he's been telling member banks, and he's also, I don't think he has in his testimony, but as an attorney in private practice, he has dealt with several Measure 37 claims here in Salem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm an attorney here in Salem, and I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I've prepared some testimony, which I believe has been distributed to you, and you have a lot of people here tonight, and I'm not going to take the time to read through that. I hope you'll find the time to look at that when it's convenient for you to do so. I'll just add a couple of thoughts to what Tim has said, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions. Again, we're coming at this from the perspective of the lending community and wondering when it will be, within their view, safe to make loans on Measure 37 properties. I don't think we're there at this point. Their concerns, I think, relate almost entirely to the fact that the waivers that are granted by state and local government are not transferable. They're personal, as you know. And so if your borrower who has gotten these waivers comes in with an application to build a house or a subdivision or whatever, you have to kind of become a life insurance company, because one thing that could happen during the course of the development process is your borrower might die. And if that doesn't happen, your borrower might default. You've always got the risk of default in a lending situation, but typically you also have the security, and the value of the security is not going to change drastically because of the borrower's default. So we're looking at these in a completely different way, and I'm really kind of grateful that the bankers have not had a lot of pressure from their customers to grant these loans. I don't know whether there's some sort of a private market that's developing to finance Measure 37. I think there's probably some of that going on, but we're just not seeing much activity at this point within the financial institutions that we represent. The problems of Measure 37 go beyond that initial development. I think there are lots of questions out there about, assuming you get your house or your subdivision developed and the house is built, what then will be the rights of the people who buy those houses? What can they do with them? There's nothing there that really answers that, at least to my reading of Measure 37, in terms of what rights the ultimate user of that home or other development might make of that property, and whether you can add on to it. Is it some sort of a non-conforming use? Those are pretty important questions when you're investing $500,000 or so in a new McMansion out in the countryside. So Those problems, I think, are also bothering the banking industry. And we also had questions about the impact of Measure 37 on where you, your bank, has a mortgage on a property that's adjacent to a Measure 37 property, and how the granting of a Measure 37 claim can have a profound impact on the value of the property that you've made a loan on. And that, of course, comes along after the fact, and there's not much you can do about it. So there are a variety of things that we're puzzling over. We don't have any more answers than you do at this point. We're hoping that this session of the legislature will begin to shed some light on these and bring some reason to bear on them. We don't have any particular axe to grind, but lenders really don't like uncertainty. And I think that's probably the most important message that I can convey to you. And with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Well, why don't we go through the panel entirely before we open it for questions from the members of the committee.
Okay. Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Christy Stevens, and I'm the state president for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. At this time, we do not really have a position. I personally own a mortgage company in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and have had no cases involving Measure 37. I had an opportunity to phone my appraisers today, as well as some of my lenders, and none of which have had any issues with Measure 37. So not a lot to report, but no position at this time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Our membership ranges from mortgage departments of Tim's Banks to commercial lenders like National Mortgage and Norse Biggs. I've surveyed our membership, and we have had almost no activity relative to Measure 37 either. And I did talk to one member today who did have a couple of applications involving Measure 37 claims, and they just chose to pass on them. So I really don't have much more to add than that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Tim, I'll direct this to you simply because I've known you longer. Our joint development partnerships a viable alternative to transferability?
Anyone take that? Yes, Representative Garrard, I think they can be if they're very carefully drafted and put together. It's like any partnership. It can be a difficult relationship, and there's a lot of unknowns there, but I think they're feasible, and we've seen some of our clients who have moved in that direction.
And let me add, and Ken can jump in here as well, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard. You know, the other thing I know, Ken has actually issued, and I will provide for the committee copies of some of the articles that he's sent out to banks around the state, kind of trying to provide some guidance on Measure 37 issues. And I know one of the things he did early on was suggest that a bank take a power of attorney, that might be also a way to prevent a potential problem if the borrower should die or go in default. I don't know if Ken wants to add any more on that or not.
If that's what was my advice, I'm withdrawing it. Well, power of attorney, of course, dies with the person who's given it. So I'm not sure the context of what you're referring to, but that wouldn't do it.
Yeah, we talk in the legal business about durable powers that survive the incompetence of the giver, but I'm not sure there is a version that survives death.
Exactly.
Further questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wanted to throw this out to all of you. I think that I'm aware of at least three firms that have initiated joint development agreements, basically due to the Cook County case, and in essence, which are seen as a huge inflow of private capital into this to deal with it. And what they're doing then is issuing a life insurance policy on the person to cover their investment. They initiate it once the rights vest, then they build. You guys consistently have loaned on non-conforming uses. Are you at all concerned? I guess what you're going to end up with is a number of non-conforming uses, which is fine. But are you at all concerned that perhaps some of the private development firms are jumping out in front? And is that concerning you as far as market share issues? I mean, would you, from your perspective, when you look at transferability, what's going to happen is this going to be done in private financial institutions. Would you prefer us to fix the transferability issues so that banks have more security in that situation?
If I can respond to that, I would certainly like for you to fix the transferability issue, not just for the financial industry, but for everybody in the state. I think that right now every citizen who has any direct or indirect relationship to all of this has some burden that they're carrying as a result of that issue. I don't think lack of clarity is a good thing, and so I'd surely support clearing that up one way or the other.
If I can make you a quick comment, I just think that what the Cook County case and the Jackson County case done, it basically done nothing more than transferred it from lending institutions that are more regulated to private institutions or private funding firms that are not. And I just think that that's kind of what I wanted you guys to get at. Just all it's done is shift to the lending source. Thank you.
Any further questions for this panel? Senator Przanski.
Ms. Stevens. I'm not going to let you off the hook with just no position. If someone came into your business tomorrow and said they wanted to get some type of funding and on a loan basis or whatever, they just said, I've got this claim that's been approved by the state as well as the county, and we want to build. What's your response going to be?
Well, I'd have to research the area and the lender. You know, it's really lender-specific. We work retail with our consumers. So these guys have the brunt of the problem, we just may not have seen it yet. My opinion is this is going to end up more being a commercial issue rather than a residential, which is where we focus.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
If there are no further questions for this panel, then thank you very much for coming to the committee and sharing this information. Our second panel, as announced earlier, will be the Oregon Farm Bureau. I think we have Don Schellenberg on the list here. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I had to wait for traffic to clear there, so I apologize for the tardiness of getting up here to the podium. The Oregon agriculture industry has grown continuously for more than 20 years and now contributes more than $4 billion to the state gross product when it leaves the farm gate, and that's each year. Adding a conservative multiplier, and that ramps up to $12 billion added to Oregon's economy each year, and that's whether or not the producer turns a profit. So simply to say there that whether or not agriculture industry is profitable, it has a very large economic impact on the state and the stability of the state's economy. On the labor side, 1 in 12 jobs in Oregon are agriculture-related. That success and the economic stability that agriculture brings to the table is due in part to Oregon's land use planning program. I remember being in the Farm Bureau House of Delegates in 1973, which was our organization's legislative body, as a young farmer and debating the pros and cons of implementing land use planning in rural Oregon. Ultimately, the organization did support the plan and has done so continuously. That's not to say that the program is perfect. Indeed, we've argued for some changes every year and will do so again this legislative session. So what benefit has agriculture gained from land use planning? And there are several. First and maybe foremost, in exclusive farm use zones, we have the ability to conduct agricultural practices without conflict from non-farm activities. And that's a real crucial issue. I say we have that ability. It is eroding and has eroded over the years, but it's still better than not having any land use planning and not having any exclusive farm use zones. Farming and ranching can be a dirty, stinky, noisy, dangerous job. Quite different from what our city cousins envision when they dream about moving to the country for the good life. The land use planning program rightly makes it difficult for non-farm uses to locate in the farm zone. Closely related to that, the planning program stopped leapfrog housing developments in the farm zone. The only thing worse than one non-farm dwelling next to you is two non-farm dwellings or more. Secondly, the program provides certainty for all types of property owners. The homeowner in a residential zone can be certain that a noisy manufacturing plant will not be sited next door to their residence, and thereby devaluing the property. And the farmer can be certain that a housing development will not be sited next door, requiring a change in farming practices. Agriculture production is a long-term enterprise that requires expensive investments that must be amortized over a long period in order to justify the expense. Land use planning provides that certainty necessary to make those investments. Prior to land use planning, there was constant speculation by non-farmers on how they might turn a quick profit or convince a farmer there was a larger profit with a non-farm use of the farmland. The result was an increase in the price of farmland to the point that producers couldn't purchase land from one another to pay for it from the profit of the commodities they produced. Then along with the increased land values came the ever-increasing property tax, even though most producers had no intention of selling their property. Although land speculation by non-farmers, and yes, even some farmers, hasn't been completely stopped, limiting the non-farm uses allowed in farm zones has been a big help. That, in turn, has helped to maintain the critical mass of farm and ranch land that is needed to maintain and support the agriculture infrastructure that is necessary to provide the supplies, services, processors, markets, and the markets for agriculture producers. The purpose of the Oregon Farm Bureau, and this is sometimes misconstrued, the purpose of the Oregon Farm Bureau is to ensure that agriculture remains constant, profitable, and viable economic industry in Oregon. A lot of people think that the purpose of the Farm Bureau is to make sure that every individual farmer is profitable. Well, that isn't always going to work. And as Representative McPherson, having been in the dairy industry, would know that high prices for alfalfa hay is not good for the dairy farmer. Unless the dairy farmer is also raising his own alfalfa, then it's okay. But what's good for one farmer is not necessarily good for the other farmer, but the purpose of the Oregon Farm Bureau is to make sure that the agriculture industry remains viable, and that at times will help one farmer and not another, and at other times will help the one farmer and not the other. So our concern is that the results of some Measure 37 waivers will seriously jeopardize that goal. Certain waivers would also be to the detriment of the open space, wildlife habitat, and environmental benefits that farm and ranch land provides, not to mention the farm fresh meat and produce from the nearly 200 commodities raised by Oregon farmers and ranchers. The Oregon Farm Bureau asks that you take a serious look at bringing some stability back into the land use planning process. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak this evening, and thank you for accommodating my request to come on early in the program this evening. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
It's our pleasure, Mr. Schellenberg. Representative Garrard.
Dodd, during the interim, we worked on a bill together that has been pre-filed that was originally sponsored by the Farm Bureau that would regionalize LCDC. Does the Farm Bureau still support that concept of regionalizing land use planning?
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Garrard, we do. And the purpose of that really is land use planning is a very complicated issue. A lot of it is centralized in that you have the statewide land use planning goals, you have LCDC, and they make the decisions on a lot of administrative rules, and it's, while they do get out into the country some, still most of the activity takes place here, and it's difficult for people to come in and be a part of that all the time. And so people don't have any kind of real ownership in that. What our sense was is that if we could regionalize those responsibilities of writing administrative rules into regions where the different regions could have a say and the people could go to their region and have input, it would bring it down closer to the people and the people would buy in better to the land use planning program. So that was our purpose for introducing the regionalization concept.
Follow, Mr. Chair. You may.
Don, I can conclude from those comments then that that you agree with the one size doesn't fit all interpretation of our land use laws.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Garrard, that was our position, and again, that was part of the reason that we supported the concept of regionalization. So there could be, in fact, different administrative rules in different regions under the same goals and guidelines.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following along that same line, Mr. Schellenberg, instead of decentralizing the whole agency, could you envision another methodology where regional views would be brought to the DLCD process? And the example that I'm thinking of is that there are area commissions on transportation that operate throughout the state, and they advise ODOT, and they advise ODOT on purely regional issues. They bring a perspective from a certain confined geographical area. Instead of actually regionalizing the agency, as long as a regional perspective was brought, could you take a look at something along the lines of the Area Commission on Transportation?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Senator Johnson, yes, we would not rule that out. In our Farm Bureau policy development process, we sometimes get very specific, and so our policy was fairly specific on what regionalization should look like. Since that time, our House of Delegates revised that and simply said we support regionalizing LCD or LCDC could include regionalization, or reorganizing LCDC could include regionalization. So they left it wide open so that we can look at other avenues of accomplishing that same goal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, you mentioned the right to farm laws, and you mentioned that they seem to have eroded, and I would like to know if you have some ideas or some specifics that where we need to strengthen these laws and how they could be strengthened in order to protect farmers' right to farm in farm zones in case there are developments next door or changes in land use practices next door.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, that's a very deep question in that you're getting into a very legal area when you talk about right to farm. But we do have the right to farm law. That is true. The only thing, the right to farm law, it's not an end-all. It's certainly a help. What it doesn't deal with is the increased number of wells that would be in the area, increased number of sanitation systems that would be in the area that may begin polluting the water. It doesn't deal with increased traffic in the area. You have more population, there's obviously more opportunity for vandalism. It doesn't deal with all of those things. But as to how we could change the right to farm, what right to farm doesn't say that people cannot bring a suit against you for nuisance and trespass. It doesn't say they can't, but they won't win. Nevertheless, that doesn't stop some people from doing that, and they can harass the grower by continually filing a suit under right to farm, and then the grower has to spend time and money defending that, even though he knows he's going to win. So if there's some way that we could ramp up the incentive not to bring a suit against the grower, that would be a help.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
You may.
Thank you. Lose your pay? Is that what you're trying not to say?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, something along that line, and I wouldn't know how to describe it, but something along that line, yes.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, I appreciate the comments in your testimony and the questions in the committee is land use fairness, not just Measure 37. So some of these broader topics I think are good to cover. But before I lose you, I did want to check in. At our first committee, we heard about kind of a clock that is ticking and some issues that need to be dealt with relatively soon. Does the Farm Bureau have a policy position on sort of the immediate clock ticking factor?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Clem, there's two different ways the Farm Bureau has positions. One is our policy book that's adopted by our House of Delegates, but on issues where our policy is silent, then we do have a 21-member board of directors that has the ability to take a position. And what I think you're referring to is what's commonly called a moratorium, I guess. And the Farm Bureau Board did take a position supporting a moratorium for the purpose of allowing the legislature to take a look at Measure 37. And in my comments, I mentioned the stability that we would like you to bring back to the land use planning process. We believe that Measure 37 has caused instability, at least in the exclusive farm use zone. In agriculture, two things are of prime importance. Number one is land. We have to have land. And number two, we have to have water. And both of those things, because of Measure 37 claims, both of those would disappear faster than otherwise. And that's a concern that the board would like to address and that they did address in supporting a possible moratorium.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. McPherson. Mr. Schellenberg, what kind of moratorium are you talking that the Farm Board has endorsed, that your Board of Directors has endorsed?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, they just made a general statement. They didn't identify what kind of, essentially what they said is a moratorium that will allow the legislature to take a look at the Measure 37 issue. It's that general. I'm sorry I wasn't more specific than that.
I was hoping for more specifics. Thank you.
What they said is a moratorium that will allow the legislature to take a look at the Measure 37 issue. It's that general. I'm sorry I wasn't more specific than that.
I was hoping for more specifics. Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. I'd like to ask you a Measure 37 question, and then hopefully they'll let me ask you a general question. But here's my concern, specifically on Measure 37, and Don, tell me if you think this accurately reflects the picture. Both of us know a lot of people in agriculture who filed Measure 37 claims. The vast majority of those people in agriculture that filed Measure 37 claims, in my view, have no intentions of acting on those. They're trying to preserve their rights. The Crook County decision and the Jackson County decision on transferability has thrown up this question that the rights travel with the individual rather than travel with the land. And my concern, my grave concern is that it doesn't really affect people who want to develop, but who this really affects are the people who just wanted to preserve their rights for future generations. And actually what these cases could do is accelerate the rate of development because of the fact that people have got to vest their rights before they die. Has the Farm Bureau taken a position on the transferability issue? Because obviously your interest would be in making sure that the Crook County, I mean, from based on your position, the Crook County and the Jackson County case do not stand where they are because it would accelerate development where you say you don't want it.
And Mr. Co-Chair, Senator George, again, our policy is silent on transferability. Once again, last year, the board actually did take a position opposing transferability, and the issue from their perspective, again, was if you have transferability, that would accelerate the number of Measure 37 claims.
Follow up if I could. How's that? How's that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it would accelerate it in that if you were the individual, you were the owner who had the property, the owner at the time Measure 37 passed, you were the owner. If you couldn't sell that property to someone else and they had the right to develop on it, likely wouldn't be developed as quickly because you may not have any reason to develop it yourself. So that would be the reason that transferability would tend to accelerate.
I think you need to talk to a few more farmers on that, Don. Can I ask them a question?
Yes, one more.
Okay. You talk about in your testimony the farmers versus non-farmers, and I just kind of want to get a definition from the Farm Bureau. If I was going to join the Farm Bureau, what level of income would I need to make before I would get voting rights status? What is the Farm Bureau view as a farmer?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator George, when you join the Farm Bureau, you join the County Farm Bureau. There is no magic number. What the County Farm Bureau, they look at each membership application and they determine should this person be a voting member or should they not. There is not a numerical number.
If I could, Don, generally, could you explain to me what would make up a Farm Bureau member? What's generally the criteria that the counties use to determine what a farmer is? I mean, because it's really key in this whole discussion of what is and is not a farmer.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator George, I cannot speak for the individual county farm bureaus. They make that determination on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. You mentioned the increased wells and concerns about water and the water rights, I assume. Do you have any specific ideas for dealing with that issue inside the current arena we have today, which is Measure 37 as it is? Do you have any specific ideas on how to address the issues of water and, you know, water rights and preserving the water rights of irrigators?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, our concern basically there lies in the area of domestic wells and what we call exempt wells. There is no requirement for a domestic well that they when they're issued the right to drill a well, they don't have to look and see whether it's going to infringe on a water right, whether it's going to go over the water table or not. All I can tell you at this point is that I'm aware that there's legislation on the House side that's going to be addressed, that would address the issue of exempt wells. And we would suggest and would agree that there should be some kind of process for domestic wells to be permitted, so that when they are permitted, it's been assured that they aren't going to draw down the aquifer, they aren't going to reduce the water for irrigation rights or for existing dwellings.
Members, I don't see any other questions, and we do have other invited testimony, so unless there are other burning questions, I'd be inclined to excuse Mr. Schellenberg. Thank you very much for being open to our wide-ranging questions on this segment.
You're welcome. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Our third organization is Oregonians in Action, and I have Dave Honeycutt on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, thank you for inviting me to testify. I appreciate the opportunity, and obviously our organization is keenly interested in this issue, having placed Measure 37 on the ballot and successfully got that measure approved in 2004. It's our hope that as you move along, that this committee makes progress on not just on 37, but also on resolving a number of issues that that we believe have plagued our land use system since the adoption of Senate Bill 100 in 1973, and that as you're doing so, you do so in a manner that reflects consensus as best you can. We having been around this building and sat in chairs, this chair or that chair, or chairs just like this in the other hearing rooms for a number of years, I can tell you that bills that come out with a strong partisan flavor tend not to do real well in this building. I'm obviously aware of politics, but am hopeful that as you move forward, you can do so in a manner that reflects consensus rather than party line politics. To that end, we have, and I have said repeatedly in the media in the last months, we've pledged our support to work with each one of you, with every legislator in this building, Republican, Democrat, to resolve these issues in a way that helps both the individual and the public. We think that can be done, and we're hopeful that can be done. And the feedback that I've received over the course of the last couple of weeks that you folks have been in session has been pretty positive. I have yet to find a legislator, and I haven't talked to all of you, but I have yet to find a legislator who believes that our current land use system is working optimally and that it doesn't need to be changed. And conversely, I have yet to find a legislator who doesn't have some ideas on what to do with Measure 37 and thinks that there are some ways that we can amend that legislation to help folks. And so I think we're off to a positive start, at least among the legislators. There are a number of issues that, as I said, that we'd like to see addressed besides Measure 37, and I've listed those. It's similar to the testimony that I took to the Big Lip Task Force 3, 4, 5 months ago. Secondary lands obviously is a big issue that it's sort of the elephant sitting in the middle of the room. 97% due to it, because of the language in Goals 3 and 4, Goal 3 being the agricultural lands goal and the definition of ag land in Goal 3 and the definition of forest land in Goal 4 and the breadth of those definitions and that language being adopted in 1975 and being essentially the same as it is today, we have 97% of our privately owned land zoned for farm and forest use, regardless of whether or not you can farm it or forest it or not. The veterans on the committee have probably heard me say that before, and I say it just about everywhere I go, but having had many conversations over the years with LCDC commissioners who are supposed to be the experts in this area, and asking them, okay, Commissioner so-and-so, how much rural land is zoned for farm and forest use, the typical answer is somewhere between 30-40%. In reality, given the definitions, we're talking about 97%, and we're all aware of lands that can't be farmed, that can't be forested, that that are zoned that way, and essentially from an economic perspective, it makes very little sense, and obviously from the perspective of the person that owns that land, that all of a sudden now has a piece of land that they can't do anything with, it's very frustrating. So if there's any issue that remains unresolved that we believe should be resolved by this committee, that's it. Local control is another issue that we hope that you'll take a look at. As Mr. Schellenberg said, in this state we have essentially statewide centralized planning. That's especially true when we're talking about rural areas. In rural areas, the county planning directors act essentially as permitting warehouses, and their response is typically yes or no. Every county comprehensive plan and zoning ordinance is required to comply with the statewide land use goals, the statutes, and the administrative rules. If you look in Chapter 660 of the administrative rules, you'll see the breadth and the detail of those rules. And if you look at the breadth of the definitions of ag and forest land in Goals 3 and 4 and natural resources in Goal 5, you'll see that there really is very little discretion for local planners at the county level to make the changes, to take the case where you've got the square peg that you're trying to fit into the round hole that doesn't make sense given the existing statutory or regulatory scheme, and yet the planners are unable to make those at the local level, and the county commissioners at the local level are unable to make those calls. And so we hope that you'll provide either at the regional level, but preferably for us, there are 36 perfectly good regions in this state, that you would look to those 36 regions. They're fully staffed with planners, and that you would look to those folks and give them a little bit more ability to make some of the local calls. When it comes to Measure 37, as I said, we are certainly interested in working with folks to make changes. We had a bill last session, Senate Bill 1037D in the D engrossed version. The C engrossed version was essentially OIA's wish list. The B engrossed version was, and the A engrossed version were Senator Ringo's wish list. And finally, at the end of the session, after rattling sabers and having 6 months of a whole lot of not fun, we came out with Senate Bill 1037D, which reflected an agreement between the governor's office and a number of us that had, cities, counties, a number of us that spent a lot of time sitting around the table. Unfortunately, that bill, while it came out of the House and was supported by the governor, died on the Senate floor, and so but I think the point of that is that it showed that we were willing and continue to remain willing to go ahead and make changes if it can make it better for property owners and protect neighboring owners' rights, give the cities and counties and the state government a little relief. Fine, we're all for that. But I caution the committee to when we're talking about this issue, not to buy into the hype. I've said repeatedly that in my opinion, Measure 37 is the most overhyped measure in the history of the state of Oregon. The parade of horribles that we read about in the paper seems endless, but as I think the panels the other day indicated, less than 1% of the state's land is subject to Measure 37 claims, and by being subject to a Measure 37 claim, that can be something as simple as somebody who wants to put a house on 80 acres. The state or the Portland state would consider that to be subject to a Measure 37 claim, or it can be something as much as somebody who wants to put a large subdivision on a small acreage. And so being subject to a Measure 37 claim doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to see a significant change or as Senator George indicated, any change on that property. I've talked to a number of claimants in the last few months who have indicated that they filed their claim to protect their rights, but for transferability, they'd have no intention of using their property, but because of the Attorney General's letter of advice on transferability, they feel compelled now to go out if their claim is approved and develop their property before, for fear that if they die, their claim will be lost and they have to vest their rights before something happens. And so, essentially, we're talking about a measure that at this point affects less than 1% of the state's land mass. Couple that with the fact that the voters have voted not once but twice on this issue in favor of property rights in the last 7 years with Measure 7 and Measure 37. And I think most importantly, what is often ignored about the measure is the health and safety exemption in the measure. The developments the parade of horribles that you read about that the opponents of the measure are often cite may appear in the claim itself, but there are a number of factors that will prohibit those developments from ever occurring on the ground, the market being obviously one of those. If I have an application in Harney County for a 400-unit subdivision, I can have, I've said a number of times, you could have no zoning in Harney County, and 10 years from now, Harney County is going to look just the same as it does right now. But the market's going to play a factor in that, but the health and safety exemption is also important. Nothing in Measure 37 will allow a property owner to use their land in a way that's going to dry up their neighbor's wells, overcrowd the county roads, create health and create septic issues or things of that nature. There's an exemption. We built an exemption into the measure for that. Those are all health and safety related laws. And we built an exemption in the measure for that. And so the reason why you haven't seen the 400 lot subdivision is because when the applicant gets their Measure 37 claim approved and moves into the development phase, the health and safety exemption will prevent that level of development, especially if it's on a smaller parcel. And finally, our concern with Measure 37, and what we hope that you strongly consider as you're talking about the issue, there are 7,000 or approximately 7,000 people who have filed claims under the measure. Those people have filed their claims in good faith. They've follow the state rules. They follow the local rules. They've paid money. I talked to a gentleman today who has spent $250,000 so far on his Measure 37 claim. To resolve Measure 37 in a way that deprives those people of their rights, we believe is unconscionable. They've followed all the rules and spent significant amounts of money. I would suspect that if that type of bill would move forward, you would see probably a fair amount of litigation from those claimants who I think would feel quite aggrieved by having all of their hard work essentially thrown away. We're aware of Governor Kulongoski's comments to the press, his recent press release. We hope that doesn't become the tone that's set by this committee. The claiming that if Farmer Jones wants to build one house on his property, that he's somehow virtuous, but if he wants to divide his property, create three lots, and put a house on each one of his three lots for his three children, that he's a developer, a speculator, or a corporation, I think is grossly unfair and something that is insulting to the many Measure 37 claimants that have made claims. In the same vein, we would oppose a moratorium essentially because it hurts the most vulnerable Measure 37 claimants of all, and that is the elderly folks. The best claims under Measure 37, and what you'll see as you go through the process and look at the claims, the best claims under Measure 37 are from those people who have owned their property since prior to 1973. The three big events of the Oregon land use law being the adoption of Senate Bill 100 in 1973, the adoption of the statewide land use goals in 1975, and the adoption of House Bill 3661, which created the 80-acre minimum parcel size, 80 or 160-acre, and really when we're talking about an 80 or 160-acre minimum parcel size, we're talking about 159-acre and a 319-acre minimum parcel size, because if I'm in a 160-acre zone and I have 319 acres, I can't divide that into two because I'd leave one parcel that was smaller than 160 acres, and that would obviously not be allowed. And so those are the three big dates as far as land use planning in this state. And what we've seen is that the best claims are from those folks who have owned their property prior to 73. It's a small subset of people. It's an elderly subset of people. And any moratorium that's enacted, essentially, if the Attorney General's transferability ruling holds, if those people die while the moratorium is in place, their claim goes away. And so we talk so often when we're talking about Measure 37 about Dorothy English, and every time I read an editorial in the paper, there's some mention of Dorothy English, and every time I read a letter to the editor in the newspaper, or even from the opponents of the measure, it's something about Dorothy English. I can tell you now that at 94, Dorothy was the first one who filed her Measure 37 claim. She filed it on December 2nd of 2004 at 12:01 a.m. If you enacted a moratorium or sped up the people who wanted to build one claim on her property, you'd move her to the end of the line. There are hundreds of Dorothy Englishes. It's not just Dorothy. But essentially what would happen is that Dorothy is statistically likely, although I hope this doesn't occur, but she's statistically likely to lose her claim based on a moratorium. And I think if there's one thing that we can all agree on, it's a fool's errand to try and go out and figure out what the people wanted with Measure 37. The only way to resolve that is to go out and ask the million people that voted for it what they wanted, and the million people, or the 600,000 or whatever it was, people that voted against it, why they voted against it. If we ask all of you why you either opposed or supported Measure 37, you'll probably get different answers from each one of you. So I think it's a fool's errand to try and figure that out. But what I hear repeatedly, especially from the opponents, is the reason that people voted for Measure 37 is to help Dorothy English. The legislature tried to help her in 2003. They passed a bill that allowed her to create 8 lots on her property. That bill was vetoed by the governor in 2004 when she submitted her application. She asked for 8 lots, the exact same thing that this legislature tried to give her in 2003. If we have a plan that lets people build one house and moves everybody else either to the back of the line or not at all, Dorothy won't get any relief, and the people like her won't get any relief. So the last thing I'll say, unless there's any questions, is my pledge to each of you is that I'm happy to work with each one of you individually, together. It doesn't matter. There's a way to get this done. There's a way to resolve these issues, and I'm happy to work with all of you to try and find that solution.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. This is a little bit tangential, but you've opened such a tempting door, I want to ask you. In talking about the 36 perfectly good planning units out throughout Oregon in the counties that are fully staffed with planners, would you have an opinion about how reasonable it would be to require initial certificates of competency for planners and then continuing education like CLE, like continuing legal education, to keep planners current?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator Johnson, this is deja vu. I had this conversation with Senator Ringo a couple of years back. I hesitate to force that on any other profession, not liking that as a member of the Oregon State Bar. On the other hand, I think that would be, that's a worthy idea. And one of the things that I find as I talk to planners, is that a lot of them don't understand some of the basic laws, the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, the provisions in Chapter 197, and so it's an educational process. And so anything that would help in that regard, I think, would be great.
Mr. Chair. And I'm also thinking about some of the esoterica involved in wetland delineations and some of those sorts of things, and my fear that some people have become frustrated with the land use process because anybody can hang out a shingle announcing themselves as a land use planner, and mistakes are expensive and sometimes not retrievable.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that's right, and this is a very complicated area of the law. There's a Senate Bill 100 created not one but 2 state agencies. It created a specialization in the law. There's land use lawyers. We're our own unique group. We know a whole lot about land use law and usually not very much about any other kind of law, simply because land use is one of those areas where you either know it or you stay the heck out.
Thank you.
Representative Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 quick questions, if I may. 1, Dave, do you agree, excuse me, do you agree that Measure 37 needs some clarification?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Guard, I think we made that point clear in 2005 with Senate Bill 1037-D. Senate Bill 1037-D, just for the rest of the committee to maybe not have followed that, was the result of a lot of hard work by a lot of talented people, and Chandler and I sitting in the room with them. there was a lot of thought and effort went into that bill. It's a process bill. It's a legal bill, but it represents, I think something that makes Measure 37 better for everybody: state and local governments, claimants, property owners, neighboring property owners, everybody that has a stake in the bill.
2nd quick question, okay. Mr. Chair. If this legislative body takes no action on Measure 37 this session, is there a discussion as to a possible new ballot measure?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Girard, that's an interesting question. There's always that discussion. and that could come from folks on either side. Frankly, I'm tired of ballot measure wars, but on the other hand, we've been fairly successful with them. They're expensive. My stomach lining has a hard time taking them anymore, and I'd like to get these issues resolved here. I think it's, in my mind, and I don't mean to throw stones, in my mind, the problem is the failure by the legislature to address these issues over the course of three decades. And every session, the number of little old widow types or farmers or whatever that had problems that couldn't get resolved grew longer. And we, you know, that you were the chair, Representative Girard, you heard many times from people. I can't tell you how many people have sat up here with me and cried. Well, they describe whatever their problem is, and if it doesn't get resolved here, it's going to get resolved at the ballot box.
Thank you.
Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dave, in your testimony, I guess I'm puzzled about a couple things. I just want to get some clarification, because I've had a number of people come into my office, as you have, to talk to me about the issues. Regarding secondary lands, the vineyards, many people said that those lands could not be used for farming for agricultural purposes 20, 25 years ago. And now today we see many of these areas that have been, that would be classified maybe as not usable for what was considered agricultural at that time, now being a very vital part of our economy in these areas. So is it the vineyards? Many people said that those lands could not be used for farming for agricultural purposes 20, 25 years ago. And now today we see many of these areas that have been, that would be classified maybe as not usable for what was considered agricultural at that time, now being a very vital part of our economy in these areas. So is it your position that once something has been considered secondary lands, that it's never going to be able to be viable within the agricultural industry?
Chair, Co-Chair Brzozinski, no, that's not our position. In fact, the secondary land zoning designation would simply authorize alternative uses in those particular areas. Whether those uses actually occur or not would be up to the market and the individual property owner. Or alternatively, and what we've suggested in a pattern that would be similar to Washington's Growth Management Act, Washington is the state that has a little bit of statewide centralized planning like Oregon's. Beyond that, there isn't anybody. Under Washington's Growth Management Act, they declare, I believe it's their Class 1 and 2 soils as agricultural land at the state level. And then for all the other soil types, the local governing body can decide whether they want to declare those as agricultural land or not. In my mind, that's a great solution to the secondary lands issue, because it essentially protects the state's interest in the most vital agricultural lands, and at the same time gives the local government some flexibility in those areas to say Yamhill County could go in and say, okay, for this area of hillside lands with south slopes, we're going to declare those as agricultural land as well, and Washington County may choose not to do so.
Okay, thank you. If I can follow up.
You may.
Regarding the statement that Measure 37 claims affect less than 1% of Oregon's lands, well, if we take out the federal lands, which are 54% ownership, state lands, which I'm not sure what percentage of the public lands, do you know what the actual amount of private land that's in the state that would be in that formula?
Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I believe it's somewhere just slightly above 1%, 1.5%, I believe, is the number that I've heard, but I haven't checked that for sure. The fact remains that on those federal lands are already off-limit to any type of development, and so unless the federal government authorizes it, and so we're not going to see, we're obviously not going to see any development on those 35 million acres.
All right, but I guess to me it seems like we're maybe comparing apples and oranges, and so all the apples being in one bushel, as to just looking at what would be potentially developed under what is private lands versus what are public lands.
That very well could be.
Okay. If I could follow up with two more.
Yes.
regarding the health and safety exemption, I heard you say, and I want to make sure I understood that, is that's the water limits. That would be, is that a factor that is going to be able to be considered by the county planners? Based on what we've heard from the Oregon Farm Bureau, they say domestic wells are exempt from that type of process.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, there's some legislation that apparently will make us all meter our wells if it passes. I live in a rural area. I talked to some of my neighbors about that. They're not very excited about that, but setting that aside, the answer to that is when we drafted the health and safety exemption in Measure 37, we left it broad, and then we defined some of the, we included a such as clause because we didn't feel like we were capable of capturing every particular category of health and safety regulation. The academics, the courts, legislatures for years have struggled with what a health and safety regulation is for purposes of zoning versus a regulation that provides benefits to the public. So we didn't try and do that. A development that will dry up a neighboring well, a residential well on a neighbor's property, would create a health and safety issue. A health and safety issue for the neighboring property owner, and the health and safety exemption doesn't just apply to the development that occurs on the subject parcel. It applies to development that will occur on adjoining parcels and in the community as well. The answer to that and is we've said and will continue to say that Measure 37 doesn't give somebody the authority to go out and make a development that's going to dry up a neighboring property owner's well, overcrowd the roads, or create septic issues.
And lastly, if I could, Mr. Chair, regarding the statement attributed to the governor as to the number of claims that have been filed, his position, I should say, on one time or small owners building a home, then I thought you said that somewhere he stated that if a owner of land wanted to build three houses, that they were developers. I was just wondering what press release you were talking about, because I've looked at the January 19th one, which is the one I'm most familiar with. I didn't see that in there, so I'm wondering if there's another press statement that we should be looking at.
Mr. Co-Chair, in that, I believe it was last Friday the 19th,
yeah.
In that press release, you'll see something along the lines of for every claimant seeking one house on their property, there are six claims filed by speculators, corporations, and developers.
Yeah.
And so apparently if Farmer Jones wants to put two houses or three houses or four houses on his property, he's a speculator, corporation, or developer, which I think would shock a lot of folks around the state.
Senator George.
If I could answer Senator Brzezinski's question, there's about 26.7 million acres of private rural land, which would make the statistics we got from Portland State University about 1.5% of the private rural land in the state of Oregon. If you add in the stuff inside the urban growth boundary, it gets to a little over 27 million acres of private land in the state of Oregon, just so you know.
Great, thank you.
If I could, Dave, I want to ask you a question that I think you're probably the only one that actually knows, and I actually know the answer, but I want to get on the record. State agencies reported before the campaign on Measure 37 what it would cost to process the claims on Measure 37. It goes to credibility. What do they say that would be?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator George, that was strange.
it's a softball.
Yeah. The fiscal impact statement for Measure 37 when it was on the ballot indicated that the cost to process claims under the measure would be about $350 million a year. That was the cost to process claims, not the compensation costs. There was a report in the New Oregonian about midsummer of last year where they went out and analyzed and asked the counties how much it would cost to process claims in the state. And the actual amount to process claims under the measure to date had been about $3 million rather than $335 million or $350 million, somewhere $335 to $350 million. So the fiscal was only off by about 99%.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the exchange you had with Senator Prozonsky and ask the question about the health and safety. If I am sitting in my house and I see a Measure 37 claim across the fence that could potentially yield many, many units, at what point do I raise the health and safety exemption? My well is still functioning. It may not be when 700 additional straws are put into the aquifer. What's my prophylactic against finding out that my well sucked dry after I have 700 neighbors?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, the answer, this has been a source of frustration, I think, not just for me, but also for neighboring property owners. Measure 37 is, for most people, is a two-stage process, because most people bought their land when there was some type of procedural process in place. And so when Measure 37 provides, first you file your Measure 37 claim, you file it with the city or the county, and you file one with the state usually, you get that decided. And during the course of that hearing, those issues that you're talking about aren't relevant. A lot of people get frustrated because they believe that, that's the time to raise these issues, and it isn't. Once you get your Measure 37 claim approved, then essentially you know what the rules are that apply to your underlying land use application. And at that point, you turn around and submit an underlying land use application, and all of those issues would become relevant at that point. I'm not an expert on water, but I know that I believe that the way that you would measure and calculate whether or not a development would cause problems for you would be to go out and hire a hydrologist, I believe, is the expert that would handle that, and have the hydrologist prepare a report that would calculate whether or not the number of the development on the proposed development on that property, because at the time you have your land use application, you would have a specific proposed development given whatever rates. I assume they use an average rate of daily use per whatever it is that you're proposing, would somehow impact your ability to service your house. That's the way it would be done.
Members, by my rough calculation, we've spent over 40 minutes now with Mr. Honeycutt, and if we were to spend as long with 1,000 Friends Witness, we wouldn't hear anything within at least our traditionally allotted 2 hours from Mr. Wilkinson and Mr. Chandler, and I'm sure we want to make sure that there's time for those. So I'd say if there's a question that's really burning, we got to get it out there. We should do it, but otherwise we could.
I have third and fourth grade boys basketball practice. I'm the coach at 6:45 in Hillsboro, so I think I'm going to be a little late. So I'd like to go too.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Honeycutt. We appreciate your time. Next, we have 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Mr. Eisenbeis.
Co-Chair McPherson, Co-Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, thank you for your invitation to testify before you here this evening. For the record, my name is Daniel Eisenbeis. I'm Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Though I've been at 1,000 Friends for a few years, this is my first session working in the building. And as somebody who went to high school a stone's throw away from this Capitol building, I'm honored to be giving my first legislative testimony this evening. And to put any speculation to rest, I was born in 1980, just in case you were wondering. The issue before you here, reform of Measure 37, is perhaps the defining issue facing this generation of Oregonians. Our success or failure to adopt a solution will greatly influence the future of each Oregonian's quality of life and the character of the state that we choose and love to call home. Over 30 years ago, another generation of Oregonians, led by Republican Governor Tom McCall, rose to a similar challenge. Oregon's livability has been enhanced and protected by our land use planning framework put in place by that earlier generation. Today, the unintended consequences of Measure 37 present an imminent threat to all of us. I will not belabor the magnitude of this problem, for I believe that everyone in this hearing room knows the current situation is untenable. As this committee learned on Tuesday, upwards of 500,000 acres, that's 800 square miles, are directly impacted by Measure 37. To put that in another perspective, 500,000 acres is the area of Portland, Eugene, Salem, Bend, Medford, and all of Hood River County combined. The vast majority of these claims are on farm and forest lands. Claims for poorly planned subdivisions and other development not only stand to remove those lands from natural resource production, but also undercut the ability to effectively manage adjacent lands. In Oregon's towns, we've seen multiple claims for bigger billboards, and in my own neighborhood, even to benefit Walmart, the world's second largest corporation. The fact is, these exemptions from land use protections come at the expense of neighbors. And in the end, taxpayers in the community. It is neighbors whose own livelihoods are now at risk. It is neighbors who are now having the predictability of zoning regulations pulled out from under them without at least an assurance to have a say in the matter. Each and every one of us lives down the road from someone else. Each of us as taxpayers will be left holding the bag to provide road improvements and services to these subdivisions. Already, state and local taxpayers are throwing money down a seeming rabbit hole to process and litigate these claims. Meanwhile, the character of our communities and state stands to be upended. The very same day that Oregon Public Broadcasting, last week, quoted Oregonian Inaction's Dave Honeycutt as saying, quote, "There hasn't been one, not one of these large subdivisions," unquote. The station also reported on a 43-unit subdivision in Clackamas County proceeding to development based upon a Measure 37 land use waiver. And that's not the first subdivision that's moved forward, nor will it be the last. Like an increasing number of cases around the state, that particular subdivision involves a developer who is not the landowner. At the height of the flood that doubled the number of claims statewide in late 2006, the Register Guard reported that, quote, "potential developers prowl for Measure 37 windfalls." Senator George has informed me that no fewer than four, I know he said three tonight, maybe it's three, maybe it's four, speculative companies have been formed to profit off of Measure 37 development. While moneyed interests see a golden legal loophole, the individual homeowner that Oregon voters clearly had in mind when passing Measure 37 has been left in the lurch. Rather than provide a straightforward way for individuals to build a single-family home, Measure 37 provides windfalls for those who can afford the attorneys to navigate such an ambiguous law. Measure 37 in its current state is not only unworkable, but irrational. Right now, despite a ballot title that spoke of compensation for reduction in property value, Measure 37 claims are being submitted and approved based upon the speculative value of a land use waiver, which of course incorporates the monopoly value of one's neighbors continuing to follow the rules. The value of these claims exists only because our land use laws continue to apply to the rest of us. Even Oregonians in Action's own arguments before the Supreme Court in McPherson versus Das disagree with how Measure 37 is actually played out. This may seem like a moot matter when governments around the state simply don't have money to pay for claims. But the issue is important because the amount of compensation and the value of a blank check waiver is far in excess of what most claimants may have lost. Given a Measure 37 claimant a windfall at the expense of neighbors is well beyond the intention of voters, much less anyone's idea of fairness. Measure 37 is broken, and this is the place to fix it. Despite the mess we face with Measure 37, I believe the conversation that is occurring is a healthy one. Oregonians are looking to the legislature, led by this committee, to move beyond the bill of goods that was sold to them and provide a fair and reasonable solution that works for all Oregonians, neighbors and individual homeowners alike. We can restore the homestead building right of longtime property owners and protect the livelihoods and quality of life for all Oregonians. I have confidence that your efforts will succeed, and thank you for the opportunity to inform your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenbeiss. Any questions from the committee? Senator George.
Daniel, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job, and I appreciate you coming to my office and spending so much time talking to me. I really do, and I felt like you've been sincere in those conversations, so thank you very much, although, you know, a little bit out of context. Nonetheless, I wanted to ask you generally, I understand Thousand Friends is opposed to Measure 37, and that's what your testimony says, and fundamentally you disagree with the underlying law. I find it hard to believe that this legislature would overturn something that's been passed by two successive ballot measures. So let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts. When we talk about the land use system, we talk about some flexibility on secondary lands, regionalization of LCDC, we're going back to some more local control. We're talking about some of the broader issues to fix the land use planning process, which has been clearly broken, which led to Measure 7 and 37. Where can we see some flexibilities from Thousand Friends? Clearly, I think everybody's willing to talk about fixing things, the land use process, how Measure 37 fits in that. Where do you see your flexibility from your organization?
Co-Chair Przanski, Co-Chair McPherson, Senator George, first of all, I would disagree with the assertion that 1,000 Friends of Oregon is looking to overturn Measure 37. It's a law that is clearly broken, and we would like to see it be made workable so that it's fair and reasonable. Like many other interest groups, during the 2005 legislative session, 1,000 Friends stood before legislative committee and recognized that it's time to take a comprehensive review of our land use planning program and supported Senate Bill 82, which commissioned the Oregon Task Force on Land Use Planning, a 10-member committee that was jointly appointed by the governor, Senate President Courtney, and House Speaker Minnis. That's a very diverse body. We have been engaged in that process, as have other groups like Oregonians in Action. And I'm optimistic that based on the work that they've already done, they'll be going out to engage Oregonians. I think it's critical that there be a broad conversation, including the citizens of this state, about how to prepare for the growth that we're facing. We have almost 2 million people moving to the state in the next 40 years. We need to make sure that we have the tools to accommodate those new Oregonians and keep this a great place to live. And I would say that everything is on the table in terms of the Big Look process, and certainly any proposals that come forward this legislative session will assess on their merits.
Thank you very much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Eisenbeiss.
Thank you.
You're being let off easily here. Next, we have the Oregon Forest Industries Council, Ray Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. I'm Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll try to be brief given the hour, and I've submitted written testimony, and I'll just kind of give you an overlay of that testimony. I think most of you know OFIC represents private industrial forest landowners. Those are the larger private forest landowners in Oregon. The combined ownership, and we represent virtually all of them, and the combined ownership of our members is roughly 5 million acres. And just as a little bit of a historical backdrop in terms of the land use laws in Oregon, even though those laws clearly limit the use of those 5 million acres of private property. Historically, our members have supported Oregon's land use laws, and largely for the reasons similar to what Don Schellenberg from the Farm Bureau mentioned. Our activities in residential development really don't are not very compatible, and having folks living out in the woods is not something that works very well. There's a lot of potential for conflict with our activities with logging and
slash burning and herbicides, not to mention the fire risks that are associated with development in forested areas. So over the years, we've been willing to accept restrictions on the use of our property under Oregon's land use laws for those reasons. Fast forward to 2004, OFIC did not have to take a position on ballot measure 37. Some of our members were for it, and some of them were opposed to it. I know there's some skepticism about this now, and I'll try to address this in a second, but the primary reason for the members who did support it was not because they wanted to convert their forest land to subdivisions. It was because they saw it as a potential break on what they view as a potential kind of a insidious attrition on their private property rights as a result of regulation. Our activities are highly regulated by the state of Oregon through the Oregon Forest Practices Act. And to date, the level of regulation under that law has not been, in our view, excessive, but we've seen just the opposite occur in our neighboring states. So we saw Measure 37 as a way to make sure, hopefully, that that wouldn't happen here in Oregon. And even on the regulatory front, which, again, I believe was the primary motivation for our members who support Measure 37, they were looking prospectively, not retroactively. They were not looking to file claims, try to get paid for complying with the current regulations. And those, by the way, are not de minimis by any means. Ballot Measure 7, when it was on the ballot in year 2000, part of the fiscal impact statement was an estimate of what would it cost the state of Oregon if every forest landowner filed a claim for the total cost of complying with the Oregon Forest Practices Act rules. And the answer to that question, which was part of the record in Ballot Measure 7, was $55 million a year. So that's what we're basically giving up in lost value, mainly trees that we have to leave in certain places to protect the environment. It's $55 million a year. Despite that high cost in the 2 years that Measure 37 has been on the books, as far as I know, there hasn't been a single claim filed by any member of OFIC for compensation or a waiver to avoid the consequences of those regulations. So our primary motivation was on the regulatory side and prospective, not retroactive. Now, as I just said, and as we're all aware, because of some recent filings by some timber companies under Measure 37, that rationale has been questioned by some folks, and I'd like to just put that in some perspective at least. Even if you add all those claims up, it would still be only a small fraction of those 5 million acres of industrial forest land that are represented by OFIC's membership. Secondly, as far as I know, there are no immediate plans to develop any of those acres. The companies that filed those claims have, I'm not privy to their business plans or exactly what they have in mind, but I'm relatively certain that there's nothing imminent in terms of filing an application to subdivide any of that property. And finally, as you all know, our land use process has not been repealed by Measure 37. Many of those acres are likely to ultimately be deemed unsuitable or ineligible for development just through the permitting process and the local planning ordinances that they still have to go through. So hopefully that puts that in a little bit of perspective. And I guess the final thing on the category of perspective, four of the five largest private forest landowners in Oregon, all of which are OFIC members, filed no Measure 37 claims. I guess to just complete that thought, we're not filing claims on the regulatory side, on the development side. Most private industrial forest land is either too remote to be suitable for development or it hasn't been owned long enough to be eligible for a Measure 37 claim by the current owner. There's been a lot of changes in forest land ownership in recent years. A lot of the land has been recently purchased by its current owners. Therefore, they wouldn't have a Measure 37 claim. So because of the remoteness or the time of ownership or both, we don't believe that even if Measure 37 survives intact and is not modified somehow, the impact on private forest land is not going to be as great as some might think. And the best way, we believe, to minimize, either with or without Measure 37, to minimize the risk that someday you're going to see large-scale conversion of forest land to development is to make sure that the regulatory climate in the state stays at a reasonable level. So
and we've been saying that for a long time. A couple of caveats to that kind of broad overview of our historical opinion about the land use laws and Measure 37. In some places, there are going to be circumstances where because of encroaching urbanization or other factors, continued use of land for forest, traditional forestry, is just impractical. A good example is one of our members owns 100-plus acre block of forest land immediately contiguous to Forest Park, and I think it's within the city limits of Portland. It's in Multnomah County. To think that you're going to be able to spray herbicides from a helicopter and burn slash right next to Forest Park in Portland is not feasible in this day and age. So a place like that probably ought to be developed. It wouldn't be incompatible with the land use pattern in the adjacent areas, and the proceeds from the landowner could be used to purchase forest land in other areas that would be more suitable for forest use. Another example I'd just like to mention where the land use system doesn't fit very well with what's unfortunately happening socially and economically is in eastern Oregon, where the forest infrastructure has basically collapsed in eastern Oregon. There are very few mills. It's largely because the federal forests have been shut down, so the supply of timber has just been shut off. The spigot has been shut off. The mills have gone away. There's still a few. There's not very many. If you're a private forest landowner over there, you have very limited opportunities to market your logs. There's nowhere to sell your logs, virtually nowhere. It's very limited. So is it right for the land use laws that were adopted 30 years ago before this phenomenon occurred to continue to say, well, you can't use your land for anything else other than timber production? So that's just an anomaly that's just to be aware of. Final thing I'd like to just comment on is just speculating a little bit on how OFIC members might react to proposed revisions to Measure 37. Based on the testimony received the other night from Lane Shetterly and Art Schlack, clearly there's a problem with just administering the claims that came in. And we certainly wouldn't be opposed to extending that 180-day period for that purpose, just to allow the system to catch up in processing the paperwork. I don't know if that is the same thing as a moratorium or not. We hear the word moratorium a lot. I'm not sure what that means. It probably means different things to different people. And, how we would respond to that would probably depend on the details and what the purpose of that would be. As other people have testified here tonight, there are some major questions about the wording of Measure 37 that continue to be unresolved, and I think if the legislature amends Measure 37, hopefully those will be resolved. The transferability of waivers is one. The chain of title question about, ownership, what was the acquisition date, those sorts of things ought to be resolved somehow, and we would, particularly if the scope of Measure 37 is limited, so that there are fewer claims allowed than would be otherwise, we would hope that the claims that are still allowed would be allowed to be, if a waiver is granted, that waiver could be transferred to a subsequent owner. And then just generally speaking, this is very general, if a revision to Measure 37 limited its utility to act as a shield to potential excessive regulation of land management practices in the future, which, again, as I said at the beginning, was the major reason why most OFIC members supported Measure 37. If it had that effect, we would probably oppose those revisions quite strenuously, and that would be pretty unanimous. If, on the other hand, a revision of Measure 37 restricted the ability, the development side of Measure 37, you'd have a mixed response from OFIC members. Some would resist that. Others who have no intention ever wanting to develop any part of their property would have no reason to oppose that. So they would be, but on the regulatory side, that's we really do view this as a tool that protects us, that creates regulatory stability, which is important to the business climate of owning and managing forest land, which is a long-term proposition fraught with risk. So that's a real value of Measure 37, and we would fight to retain that if we were able to. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd take any questions you might have. Co-chairs.
Any questions? Representative Klim.
Yes, and I know we have at least one more speaker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray, first of all, I wanted to thank you. This is a very illuminating position. It's much more complete than a lot of people are able to give at this point. So thank you for that. I do have some questions, however, of course, about it. For example, on the question of the, quote, moratorium, and you talk about would depend on the details. For I guess in your final point being, if it was on, in the end, land use related matters only and didn't have to deal with, you know, the legislature attempting a Forest Practices to act, that's the kind of detail that makes your membership more interested in it rather than less.
Right. Let me give you, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, one specific example of things that we've heard or been proposed that could limit the utility of Measure 37 in terms of it being a shield to excessive regulations. Currently, on what's called a large fish-bearing stream under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, we're required to leave a buffer of 100 feet on each side. The trees have to, most of the trees within 100 feet of that stream have to be left for environmental purposes. Supposing in the future the state, the Board of Forestry said, no, it's got to be 200 feet. One argument we would be, if unless we agreed with that, we probably wouldn't, we would be inclined to resist that and oppose that and say, well, we're going to file a Measure 37 claim to get a waiver from that. But one of the provisions of Measure 37, one of the exceptions is the federal exemption. Anything that's required by federal law, you can't file a Measure 37 claim. Well, you can argue that buffer requirement is intended to meet water quality standards, which in turn is a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act. You can argue the other side of that argument also, and that issue will be argued. But if a rewrite of Measure 37 was to change the language of that federal exemption clause to make it less likely that we would prevail on that argument, we would resist that strenuously. One other example is I've heard of a statute of limitations, for lack of a better term, for future regulations. If that 200-foot buffer was put into place in the future, you'd have 3 years to file a claim, and if you didn't file it within that time, you'd lose it. Well, you could have a young stand of trees that wasn't old enough to harvest for the 20 years from now, and if you've missed that window, you lost your opportunity to file a claim on that excessive regulation. So those are just two specific things we've heard as things that could affect the regulatory side of Measure 37 that we would have a problem with. I hope that's somewhat responsive to your question, Representative.
I think so. If I could just follow up real briefly. And for example, the riparian zone setback, that you've principle behind that in sort of layman's terms, I take it, is if society wants to see additional protections, you would like to have the option to let society help pay for that in a very full way, depending on how that gets valued.
That's correct, Rex. Up till now, we think the state has been fair in how they've regulated our practices, and we've been willing to shoulder the entire cost. But there are other states we've seen that just get clear out of control, and we don't want to see that happen here in Oregon. If it did and a Measure 37 was available to us to help defend ourselves, we'd do it.
Sure. And just one more question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
On the bottom of page 3, I just want to make sure I've got this right in my head. If there were a narrowing, and I think we talk about in class, and we've just talked a little bit about how you might narrow in class, I think what you're saying here is your position would be the transferability. So let's say you limited it down to Farmer Joe and his one house or two houses. You're saying in that case you would like to see the transferability go on to a wife or a child.
Yes, Representative Clem, I'm not saying what we would support in the way of narrowing the scope, but if the scope is narrowed, then the transferability issue ought to be resolved at the same time, and not just to a wife or a child, but to a subsequent owner, mm-hmm. even a non-related.
Ledge, and I'm done, I swear. Okay. Just a little comment. I mean, I particularly want to also note at the top of page 3, this is more a philosophical thing, but I want to just note, and I don't know the Senate membership, but you have 4 members of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Policy Body, or Policy Committee here, and that is essentially saying that if Oregon can make the natural resource economy, whether it's agriculture or timber, profitable, then the hope would be no one would ever have to exercise a Measure 37 claim because we've done our job and nobody needs the right.
That would be a good, a fair statement, Representative Clem.
Thank you.
Committee members, we have about 10 to 7, and we still have to hear from Mr. Chandler yet, so if there are important questions.
Ask him a couple more questions.
We need to ask him more questions to cut his time down.
But I see none. So, Mr. Wilkinson, thank you very much. And Mr. Chandler, if you could come forward and share with us the perspective of the Oregon Home Builders Association, we would be grateful.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and thank you to the members of the committee for not succumbing to the temptation to run the clock out on the previous speakers. Tuesday night, I was sitting in here, and I'm appearing in front of you tonight as a member of the loyal opposition. Our association has supported the Oregon Land Use Program since its inception, and I often say that we didn't get to church for the opening hymn, but we got there in time for the collection plate to be passed. We have been supportive of the land use system. We continue to be supportive of the land use system. As I was sitting here Tuesday night, I was trying to think back over how many similar conversations I've been engaged with over my career, and it was depressing. And then I realized that because of my work in Oregon's land use system, I've put 4 children through college and 1 through graduate school, and that made me a little happier than when I heard Lane Shetterly and the counties talk about the thousands of claims and then for the thousands of court cases, LUBA cases, and appeals cases coming forward. I realized that one of my children is graduating law school, taking the bar this year, and that this might not be such a bad gig after all. And I would therefore encourage the committee not to get too carried away with simplifying things, if you wouldn't mind. We stayed out of Measure 37. We, the home builders, stayed out of Measure 37. We were not participating in the campaign. We remained neutral. That comes as quite a surprise to folks because many of my members are, in fact, developers. Most of them are corporations, and more than a few are probably speculators, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so. We stayed out of it for one primary reason, and if you don't mind, Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm going to vent here a little bit. We have tied ourselves in knots in this state for 25-plus years over whether or not somebody can go build out in a pucker brush someplace. We continue to do so. The interest of my organization, for the most part, is urban development, building cities, building communities, building neighborhoods. We stayed out of Measure 37 because, important as the issue was, it was not our core mission, which is to build cities, build in urban areas. I would encourage you, please, to let's move on to the important issues of this state. I remember some time ago talking to Governor Roberts, Natural Resource Advisor, and explaining what I thought then, and I continue to think, that if everybody in this state that wanted to go live on 5 acres out in the country did so tomorrow morning, we probably wouldn't notice it. The real issues facing Oregon are ones of infrastructure, of paying, we can figure out how to build the great cities we all want, of how to pay for those things, how to plan for those things. Measure 37, important though it is, and rural landowners' problems, important though they are simply part of the equation. And it is frustrating for my organization and for me personally that we can't seem to move beyond that. I hope that your committee can move the ball. The Big Look Task Force has been mentioned. A couple thoughts on that for you. That was our bill in 2003. It passed in 2005. I think that says something about the Oregon land use system and the task in front of you that it took 2 sessions to pass a bill setting up a task force. It shouldn't be that difficult. As you know, there's a tendentious issue. The work of that task force is in midstream. I think this committee's work could easily complement that. I would hope and ask you to coordinate your work with that of the task force to make sure there aren't conflicts or duplications. If by some happy bit of serendipity you all manage to solve the problem, they can probably go home early. I'm sure they'd be delighted. But I think that there's a possibility of overlapping missions, and I would encourage you to respect what they have been set up to do as you go forward. The final thing I want to mention, you've already heard about it, and I want to get to the specific question, but the final bit of background noise. 1037D has been mentioned several times. I was part of that work group. I guess that I spent somewhere between 5 and 20 hours a week last session on that particular effort. I don't think I've ever spent any more time on any one issue in my career. It was not a bad bill. It died in the Senate for reasons that I don't believe had a whole lot to do with the substance of the bill. Had it come forward a month earlier, it may well have had a better hearing. as it was, I would commend it to you at least as a starting point, to perhaps save a little time. I would hate to take a quiz on the particulars of 1037D right now because I've not reopened my 1037 file from last session for fear of undoing 2 years of therapy. But I think there was a lot of good work there, as has already been indicated, and I would suggest that that's a good starting point for this committee's work. With regard to the ongoing work, Mr. Chairs and the committee, I guess I have I feel like I'm a curmudgeon tonight, and I apologize. But this issue, this isn't my first rodeo on this stuff. I would urge you to be cautious about trying to read the tea leaves on the will of the voters. I don't know what they meant either, and I would submit with all respect that you don't either. That's a dangerous path to go down. There's been a lot of talk in the press about what the voters did or didn't want, and no one but the individual voters has the vaguest idea what that might have been. And I'd also caution you against assuming too much from the claims that have been filed. I've talked with some of you about this point. I know as a recovering attorney, when I was practicing, if a client came to me and had a potential claim, you would put in whatever you could claim for. What has been asked for in the MASH 37 claims, as we heard the other night, not everybody said what they wanted, but to the extent that they listed an objective, I'm not sure that's the right analysis for you folks. I think what you want to find out is what do you take? Yeah. What do you want? And I, almost in my mind's eye, have those of you who want to build a house, raise your hand, line up over here. Those of you who want to do 2 through X houses, you line up here. Those of you who want to do a mall out in the country, stand over here. We'll get to you. I mean, the sifting of this, I think, is important because not everybody who filed a claim for 30 houses wants 30 houses. They want to preserve a right. And I think to read too much into what was placed on those claims, particularly given the variety of practices around in the counties, is, again, probably not a good productive use of time. With regard to some of the issues that have been floating around on this issue, the issue of a cap, for example, we have no position on a cap in terms of what number it should be. We're not troubled by the idea that there's some upper limit on the number of dwellings that can be built on a particular piece of property. Some of the stuff we talked about in 1037, though, I think it might be helpful. It's not just the number of units. It's how they're done and where they're done. You have a hypothetical 100-acre parcel could be broken up into had a 10-acre right when they first acquired it. Having 10 houses on 10 acres has a significantly different feel, significantly different impact than 10 houses on 2 acres or acre and a half or whatever per septic tank in that particular area. There are some creative things you can do with clustering, with creating little urban rural communities that I think might be a good byproduct of the MASH 37 discussions. And I think rather than focusing on numbers and statistics, we've heard a bunch of those tonight, what you're really looking at, I think, what I hope is you're looking at, is how to make it work on the ground in a way that respects the area, respects the agricultural economy, respects the rights of the property owners, that isn't going to resolve itself nicely down to any particular equation. With regard to the claims that are in versus what's going to happen on the ground, it's been said before, I think it's worth restating, all a MASH 37 claim does, if it's granted, is give that applicant the right to not get turned down for that particular issue. It doesn't grant a development right in most cases, almost all cases. It grants the right to go apply for a development, as was discussed in some of the other testimony. And the particular interest there, the perspective that we bring to this part of the equation is, having represented builders and developers in Oregon for many years, and with all due respect to Ms. Ludwig and Mr. Schlack and the cities and counties of this state, I have a deep and abiding respect for the ability of local government to make sure that development does not occur. There has been, in my experience, no slacking of that ability. And I think that local governments are very well situated and have tools available to them to make sure the development occurs in their communities in a way that's congruent with what they want, MASH 37 waivers notwithstanding. Part of what's in front of me is how to craft this so that the outcomes are ones that are respectful of those planning processes and respectful of local government's knowledge about their community and what should work. With regard to a delay, again, it gets into parsing of terms. If a delay of some reasonable period of time allows the counties and the state to get up on top of that pile of paper, we wouldn't have any objection to it. If a delay turns into a moratorium of an indefinite period or some other method that is, unless it's deeply cynical and we're out waiting for people to shuffle off, or if there's not a Weekend at Bernie scenario or something in there, we would not support a moratorium at all. I can see giving the counties another 30, 60, 90 pick of time. I defer to their judgment on how much time they need. That seems reasonable to me, to simply put the pause button in case something, a miracle occurs down the road, does not. And finally, Mr. Co-Chair, in honor of the time, and in case there are questions, my last bit of I hate to say advice because you don't need to listen to it in that context, but an observation. This issue, and not just the Measure 37 issue, but the land use issue, is so controversial. No matter how rich each of you feel in your heart, Measure 37 meant, what the voters meant, what it should do, how it should function, and no matter how deeply you hold those, or I hold them, there's somebody else out there that holds equally deeply the exact opposite position. It did take us two sessions to pass the task force bill. I would encourage you, whatever comes out of this committee, if it is not unanimous, do not move it forward. The last thing we need in this process, the very last thing, is to have another war over Oregon land use system. It is not productive. Regardless of where you stand, I would submit to you, we have bigger problems facing us in this state than this, and we can't get to them, apparently, until we get this into bed. So please work with each other hard. I will work with you any way I can. If I can be of service, please call on me. This is an issue I care deeply about. I hope I haven't overstepped any bounds here, but it needs to be treated with the utmost in kid gloves, because it has and will again blow up if not done properly. I thank you for your time. Please call on me if I can be of service. I'll be glad to take any questions.
Mr. Chandler, you've done very well by us, and you've brought us just to the very end of our regularly scheduled time, but I do want to give the opportunity for members to ask questions. Senator Beyer.
You booked out as a comedian?
He does.
At weddings and bar mitzvahs. Yeah.
Can I ask one?
Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. John, you and I have spent way too many hours in these hearings, and I appreciated your comments early on. I want you to kind of expand on something just a little bit. Not really a question, more of an observation. We're talking here, we have packed meeting rooms over a bill that affects about 1.5% of the private rural land in the state. And I mean, when I was talking with a representative from Thousand Friends, I asked, what percentage of private rural land do you think is currently in exclusive farm and forest zones? And he said 90%. Well, shoot, that's 2.6 million acres right there that he already thought was developable and isn't. My frustration, I think, in land use has been over the last 10 years is I think most of these rural issues are fairly easy if people would actually recognize what was happening on the ground out in the rural areas. And yet, where we need the focus is really on the urban areas. It's like the entire land use system is focused exclusively on rural issues, and all the urban issues have sort of been ignored. And you alluded to this earlier in your testimony. And I want you to expand on that a little bit, because we've had thousands and thousands of units of houses built all over prime farmland in Hillsborough and Salem and Kaiser and Eugene and everything else. And nobody seems to matter because it's inside of an urban growth boundary. There's all these urban issues that are being ignored because we can't somehow come together and fix these rural problems. And if I could get your observation on that as somebody who deals in urban areas, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, yes, you've obviously, I dragged that soapbox with me. In terms of fun statistics, if I might, one of the ones that occurred to me in the back of the room, I haven't trotted this one out in a while, so I won't vouch for its exact accuracy, but the Portland metropolitan area, prior to the last round of urban growth boundary expansion, constituted, I believe, 1/3 of 1% of the state land mass and contained somewhere in the neighborhood of 38 or 40% of the state's population. I'm not sure what bearing that is on this entire conversation, but I've always found that intriguing that we've done a good job in this state of saving open space and farmland and forest land. What I have not done. I have two comments, if you wouldn't mind, Senator George, to your question. The first is, as a few, in my previous lives, I was state president of the Oregon Future Farmers of America, and I still have a little blue jacket hanging in my closet, although the cleaner shrunk it on me a few years ago. But I have a deep and abiding respect for agriculture and farming, and I have always maintained that we have done a bang-up job of saving farmland in this state. We have done a pathetic job of saving farming, and the two are just intensely and significantly different. That's observation one. Observation two is, as Senator George indicated, we have a lot of really tough, grindy noise issues inside of urban growth boundaries. Everything from what kind of density to build out to how to fund the infrastructure, and with the risk of getting into bills that will be in other committees yet this session, the unfunded liabilities for which there is no identified funding source in front of us is staggering. And when I hear Washington County talk about $60,000 per lot to run just north, south, east, west arterials to an urban growth boundary expansion area, that you cannot do that on the backs of either developers or the community. It won't work. Therefore, we have a problem. That, in my mind, and maybe I'm being parochial here, and I'll cheerfully admit to that as the, one of the hazards of this occupation, but it seems to me that those sorts of problems to which we've been able to focus very little legislative or community attention because they don't lend themselves to, they're hard. They're not really sexy issues. But they are the ones that are going to really hamper this state's development in the future economically and socially. And that takes nothing away in my mind from the rural issues, but it does, I think, indicate a lack of a prioritization that has, I hope we can get to and really talk about. It is, I think, more important, for want of a better way to phrase it.
Quick follow-up, if I could. Actually, just a comment. And, John, that's exactly my point. I find these rural issues very frustrating because I do think they're easily fixed. And when we're talking about, I mean, we draw this kind of attention to some people building some houses on 1.5% of the rural land of the state, and it draws so much media print, front-page articles. But the issues that truly affect the livability of the state, these urban issues, have been ignored by the statewide land use process, I think, in a lot of ways. And it's been a tragedy for the state. We talk about infrastructure issues. We talk about planning issues. We talk about these things, how the systems work and insert of urban growth boundaries. I just hope that maybe this committee can move towards the direction of solving some of these rural problems so we can actually focus on the planning problems that affect so many people in the state. And I appreciate your comments, John. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I'm fairly new to a lot of these debates. I'm a freshman. I have not sat in hearing rooms for decades and dealt with these things.
You're in for a treat, Representative.
Thank you very much. And I was fairly taken aback at our last hearing about the imminent situation. So I just want to talk for a moment about sort of your position or your thoughts on extension, you know, moratorium, that kind of thing. Because my constituents are interested in, you know, some of them voted for this, many of them voted for this. Some live right on Cordon Road, which is the urban growth boundary. They want to see these Oregonians in action. So my question, I guess, is to the extension position, 60, 90, 180, to get to 18 months, we've heard testimony that we have to spend $4.5 million adding 16 positions just to get to 18 months from now. So what is a reasonable amount of money to spend on this extension to get it down to 30, 60, 90? Because it, I mean, I'm not the best math guy, liberal arts OSU, but I'm looking at tens of millions of dollars. Liberal arts OSU, not science.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, philosophy George Fox. I can't do math in my head either. I'm not dodging your question. I simply don't know. I don't know if I credence this test. I'm not saying anybody was making anything up the other night. I simply don't know what the workload is or how to get on top of it. I don't know if there's other ways we could simplify it. And again, I don't mean to make light, but if you get a show of hands, everybody that in that queue that just wants to build a house, that may weed out a bunch. That doesn't mean that's the only way you stop, but that certainly lets some people off the hook. If they want to do whatever your preconception is. Beyond that, I simply don't know. I think there's the caution sign for me is, when does a delay to get paperwork done turn into a strategy to have nothing happen? And that's, no one is, in this issue, as I'm sure you know, and I realize this is your first session, but I know you've been involved in these issues, it is not only very difficult and very politically dicey, but there's not an excess of trust amongst the warring factions, and so that's a shame. But there you have it. So I'd be more than happy to sit down with folks and try to figure out what that process should be. I'll defer to the local governments in the state because that's what they do. Having said that, if it is a question of money, they didn't quit printing it. We can fund these activities if that's a priority for us. And I understand now we're just starting to see budgets and starting the Ways and Means process, and I certainly don't want to insert myself ahead of other requests. But if it's $10 million, for what I don't recall what the numbers were from the other night, but if it's $10 million gets you 18 months, if $20 million gets you 9 months, and if $30 million gets you 6 months, or whatever the math is, other requests, but if it's $10 million For what I don't recall what the numbers were from the other night, but if it's $10 million gets you 18 months, it's $20 million gets you 9 months, and it's $30 million gets you 6 months, or whatever the math is, there aren't a whole lot of things facing the state that have more potential disruptive or destructive power than this issue, in which case, if it's $30 million, let's go find $30 million. And I don't mean, obviously that's not, it's much easier said than done, but it can be done.
Mr. Chair, I think I heard a volunteer for SDCs for Measure 37 claims come out of Representative Chandler. I'm new, though.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, yes, there's a protocol on these things. There's a line for SDC.
I sense that the discussion dinging off in a new direction. Are there more questions of this witness that are on the matters at hand? If not, then thank you, Mr. Chandler. Thank you, everyone who attended. I appreciate this very informative session. We are adjourned.